cat pee.
Mmm, my favorite. Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about hop aroma today, and one of the favorite things that I've always found when you, James, talk about aroma and flavor is, wow, this one smells like cat pee.
Total cat piss. Absolutely. Ugh. God. This is not a good way to start this conversation. Good thing I got coffee right now instead of beer. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to drink it.
Mm-hmm. So how do we can subtitle this one, how to, you know, why you shouldn't drink things that smell and or taste like cat pee.
Exactly. Yes. It's half to do with chemistry and half to do with your, or in this case, my unfortunate ability to be really, really sensitive to that group of chemistry. Because some people will get a hop or a beer, like something made with citra, you know, really heavy citra bomb, and they'll call it juicy. What the hell? Juicy isn't a flavor. What do you mean juicy? So you start really poking at them, and this took me quite a while to come to you. What I realized was is that, so in that hop, you've got a lot of citrus compounds, thus the name, citra. But then you've also got this other compound, sulfur compounds. And in this case, they're thiols and mercaptans that will do, I call it, the sulfur compounds add a floor. So they add foundation under maybe a fruity flavor or a floral flavor that gives them a sense of depth. And when added in significant quantities under heavy citrus, people get like this really fruit, juicy, deep citrus flavor. To me, because I'm a super sensor for thiol compounds, all I can smell is cat piss. That's it. And so I don't even smell the citrusy part. I smell the cat pee part, and I can't get past it. In very super teeny tiny quantities, that hop, citra, is great for me. But other people just want boatloads of it because they're not sensitive. They don't find that component in it. They're either, you know, have really low sensitivity to it, or they're the mixture of that compound, those sulfurs and the citrus compounds, they're not registering it on their palate as, you know, sulfury. They're registering it as, quote, juicy. That's the magic of aroma and flavor in hops and beer, is that it's not linear.
And I'm going to say, unfortunately, when a hop variety gets hot and exciting, the easy button there is, oh, let's use more.
Totally.
Or let's make a single hop something using this. And right now, it's early 2019. Citra is the hop at the moment. It's been
one of the hops. Yeah, absolutely. Because it does have that depth, that aroma and flavor thickness, that something that's very bright and has one major dominant chemical group. You know, sort of like a one note. We talked before about, you know, having a wide palette, and instead of having just primary blue, you've got 30 different blue colors.
And really, the descriptive term juicy, to your point, juicy is not a flavor, and all it makes me think of are like the back of a pair of stretch pants, quite honestly.
Nice, yeah.
And not in a good way, yeah. Usually.
I call that moist, because, you know, everybody loves that word.
That's an even worse
everybody
word.
Loves that word. I think that's a great way to kick off this discussion about aroma and aroma chemistry, and start to maybe demystify it. The importance of aroma chemistry in hops is critical for everybody involved here in all three points of our triangle. So I think let's do our best to hit, you know, let's divide up the episode into each group. And since I'm the aroma chemistry dude, why don't you just toss some topics my way and we'll swing at them.
Sure. Well, I think it probably starts as the drinker. From a perception perspective, there's aroma and there's taste.
Right.
And you see people who are professional tasters, mm-hmm. who will... I always think of wine more than beer as the example of swirling the glass and mm-hmm. all that. But if you could start, I think, a little bit with how aroma is perceived in both the smelling of the beer and the tasting of the beer, how all that works biologically, I think would be important.
That's really, really cool. And it's cool as a biologist to say that because we don't know 100% why, but we know how this all this stuff interacts. So you've probably heard, well, you know, if you don't like the taste of it, plug your nose, because most of your taste is perception is in your nose, right? Well, no, what you're talking about there is aroma. They're, your taste buds are the ones that are firing and triggering certain groups of flavor, not aroma. So salt, sweet, bitter, you know, those are tastes. And to some extent, astringency, which is actually not a receptor on your tongue. Astringency, much like spiciness or like capsaicin, hot sauce spicy, is an irritant pain reaction. So let's not throw that in there. That's going down the rabbit hole. But it's an important combination for a sensory experience is taste and aroma. And so like when you see people swirling their glasses or slurping, the idea here is that all these aroma molecules, they're the ones that contribute things like floral and fruity and earthy and musty, and as much as I hate to say this word, dank, these are all aroma molecules, and by nature, aroma molecules are volatile. That means they take very little energy to go from liquid to gas form, and once they're in the gas form, then we can smell them. So when we're swirling the glass, when we're swishing it around in our mouths, we're also we're adding energy, and that's helping to force those chemicals out of solution and into the air so that we can perceive them against our sensory receptors. How's that sound?
That's a mouthful. I'm going to throw a wrinkle in there for you, because I happen to be rereading at the moment Beer by Charles Bamforth, a great
Charlie
book that goes in depth. But I'm in the middle of the section on foam.
Yes.
And mouthfeel and how important foam is to beers, especially certain types of beers, and I have to imagine that is also critical to aroma and to taste.
Charlie has forgotten more about foam chemistry than I will ever know. But it is hypercritical, and it's because if we look at the foam itself as part of the sensory experience, doesn't just look sexy. It's doing a very important thing. The foam bubble itself has two regions on it, the inside of the bubble, the outside of the bubble, and we call those hydrophobic and hydrophilic regions, so water-loving and water-hating. And this bubble is formed by carbon dioxide. Actually, carbon dioxide is a really great solvent. It can strip aroma out of a beer. That's why a lot of times in the brew house, when you get a CO2 blow off from the fermenter or from a bright tank or something like that, and it just smells great in there, it's like, well, dude, there goes all your aroma. The CO2 stripping it out of the beer. In your pint glass, that's sort of a good thing, because it's taking, specifically, the foam is really good at taking those molecules that don't like water, so the water-hating ones, the hydrophobic ones, and carrying them, stripping them out of the beer, and then bringing them up into your face. And the foam is very important in bringing all of those aroma molecules up to the surface and having them ready to be experienced, as opposed to having them dissolved in the liquid, and then the heat from your mouth and all the agitation from swishing and swallowing to hopefully get them into the air so that you can sense them. The foam has already done that for you. Make sense?
It does. I'm picturing beer. Drinking coffee, wishing it was beer.
Totally.
So don't get upset when there should be the right amount of head on your beer, I guess, for the full experience.
Absolutely.
You don't want half a glass of head, but none is, there's, you know, you tilt your glass, you pour your beer, you want something on there on top. It does add to that experience, certainly, if it's brewed correctly.
What else
correctly. You got? So the different types of aromas, you used, you said dank.
Ugh, I hate that word.
With dismay, but...
But it's, but it's a really good descriptor. I never have to tell anybody what dank means when I say it.
I get the imagery of, you know, being in the basement and it's moldy and mildewy. That's dank. It's humid. It's stuffy.
Well, that's because you're an old man. Everybody else associates it with pot.
Oh, okay. Yes, that's probably a more accurate descriptive term. So in terms of how aromas are classified and put them into layman's terms as far as, because there are, of course, the way brewers and Cicerones will talk about that. But to a generic beer drinker, I'll put myself in that category. You know, I don't know what piney really is supposed to mean unless it literally means eating pine needles, which it may. So take us through, if you could, the way aromas are typically classified and maybe some typical styles that go down those routes so people can connect the dots.
You bet, absolutely. So I like to classify certainly hop aroma into five different groups. And sometimes I make the argument for four, but let's just talk about five. And I sort of list them off in classes based on their how easily they are to volatilize, so how delicate they are. Let's think about them like that. And the first one at the very, very top, the ones that are really flighty and hard to get a hold of, are the floral and fruity compounds. Perfume. There's a reason why these compounds are used in perfume because they volatilize very, very easily. Perfume would do absolutely, it would be pointless if when you put it on your skin, all the molecules were so heavy and big that they never flashed off into the air and people never smelled them. So that's the idea behind, you know, you've got these floral and fruity compounds that are super light and super low energy, we call it. So that would be like compounds linalool and geraniol and citronellol. So all of these compounds that smell like flowers. So if you ever have a hop and you rub it in, or a beer, and it's like, wow, it's got this really floral, interesting, you know, nature to it, then you know that those compounds are really light, really airy, and typically are found in the largest concentrations in noble hop varieties like Hallertauer and that kind of stuff.
So what beers would I typically order? I mean, think about national ones that people would have access to, where that's where you're heading.
Think about lagers. Think about traditional English ales. Think about, you know, old world beer styles. That's where you're going to find these. You're going to find these hops in Belgians. You're going to find them, you know, in that realm. You're not going to really find them so much in IPAs. You're not going to find them in stouts so much. But you're going to find them in those pilsners and lagers and whatnot, alts and.
And when you've got these varieties that provide those types of notes, you see plenty of brewers adding flowery adjuncts,
oh, totally.
Hibiscus,
yep,
and things, yep, like that. So is that to emphasize a hop that's already doing that, or maybe to counteract a different hop that does not provide that, or is it? It depends. You can use
it depends. Like in the case of hibiscus has a considerable amount of ascorbic acid in it, vitamin C, and so it brings a tartness to the beer as well as a bit of that floral, flowery kind of thing. But hops themselves, if you're using the right hop, it's got as much or more of those floral compounds in them than most flowers that you would think of in potpourri. So, you know, if you're after linalool as a, you know, as our friend Dan calls it, old lady perfume, then that's where you're going to go. That's what it smells like. The addition of other compounds like jasmine flowers is a very, very distinctive perfume, comes from jasmine that you're not going to get from hops, but they're the same compounds. It's just in a different ratio.
Gotcha. And there's the, and I will say there's the added marketing spin of adding flowers as well, which is nothing to do with flavor and everything to do with, oh, wow, that sounds kind of
nice. Totally. Totally. The next group would be like the piney and the herbal. So when I say piney, yes, I'm talking about pine needles. So some people call Cascade piney. It smells like pine cones. So we're talking about the same compounds that are in Pinesol, alpha and beta pinene. They are volatile. It's, you know, pine pitch, pine sap, pine tar. They're volatile, but they're not like as light and airy and fluffy as as the old lady perfume, right? So they take a little bit more energy to become volatilized. Same thing with the herbal compounds. The main herbal compound would be humulene, which is one of the major hop oils. And they're responsible for this herbal kind of nature. Some people call it tea or green tea. Other people call it hoppy. So which is about as bad as dank, but this herbal quality that characterizes hops as hops, and there's really no other way to describe it other than hoppy. It's usually a blend between humulene and its sister compound caryophyllene, which we'll talk about in a second. But so these compounds are very much center point in varieties like anything bred from Brewer's Gold. So Brewer's Gold is one of those old world varieties that were bred from a wild female found in Canada way back in the day. And so you're talking Brewer's Gold, Galena, Nugget, Glacier, Chinook. So all of these types of varieties have a very heavy herbal component, Eroica. And some of the, and because it's not in favor right now in the beer brewing communities, these varieties can be hard to find. But back in the 70s and the 80s, that's really what you got, man. That's all that there was. So love them or hate them, they are very important. Brewer's Gold happens to be one of my favorite hops. It's very underappreciated. It goes really, really well and balances out against heavy malty beers. Because last thing, because we're also pulling in a lot of flavor esters from heavy malts and the yeasts that are used there. So you usually want something to counterbalance that floral compounds or ester compounds, sometimes fruity. So you go for an herbal or a pine to kind of be like on the other side of the color wheel, so to speak. And so you'll find those in usually heavier malty beers, or at least I hope so. That's where I look for them. Scotch ales. Certainly barley wines. If anybody's going to make anything imperial in order to counteract a lot of that just smack you in the face booziness, then let's look for some herbal hops in that.
Huh. Okay, interesting. So what's our next flavor, our next aroma?
I would say sort of on, so the Penthouse was old lady perfume. And the is that going to be the title of this episode? Old lady perfume.
Old lady perfume.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. And then so down from that, the piney and the herbal. Then we got tropical and citrus. So and again, these are the order in which sort of the energy it takes for them to go from your beer up your nose. And so, which is interesting. You would think that tropical and citrus, being all the rage right now, would. You say, wow, it's really impactful. There's like kicking me in the face with these tropical and citrus flavors that it would be super volatile, but they're not. So it takes a lot of them, a lot of those compounds, just the concentration in order to really kick you in the teeth. So if you look at the human sensory ability in like parts per million, parts per billion, we're sensitive to these compounds sort of in that middle range. So, which is also a reason why it's sort of right in the middle of the list. They span the spectrum of bright and lemony. So D-limonene, so that's the stuff that they put in lemon heads to make them taste super bright lemony, all the way to tropical fruit, pineapple, and almost like overripe fruit. So we're starting to get into the, quote, juicy realm again. As you see sort of the chemical partners that are on the couple of floors below this one, you'll start to understand how this concept of juicy comes about, I think. To talk about styles of beers that you're going to find these in today, like all of them, it's like the thing to do right now is citrusy and tropical fruity.
Yep. All your IPAs are
totally
doing this.
Yeah.
And to your point about, it's interesting that you said you need a lot of this to create an impact.
Well, as compared to some of the other compounds, and also a lot of hops, because these compounds aren't necessarily in as high a concentration in the hop cone as some of the ones that we talked about earlier, like linalool. So you need more of those, of the hops in the beer in order to bring that character out. Unfortunately, for some of us, me, you're going to bring along a lot of other compounds too that are going to impact that flavor. It's not just sort of a, oh, I need more citrus character, so I'm just going to load it up in the dry hop. Well, you're going to also bring in a lot of other stuff you may or may not want. So that's just not so good. So moving down the line here, then we've got our earthy and spicy compounds. So when I talk about spicy, I'm not talking about like I said, capsaicin spicy. I'm talking about clove and nutmeg, you know, typical Spice Island kind of spices. These are typically very large compounds. They tend to be more oil loving than they are water loving. And same thing with the earthy compounds. Down here is where we get sort of that black tea flavor and black currant, even some leather kind of aromas live down in this range. They are definitely not in high concentrations. Some of these concentrations in hops are at, you know, 0.001%. So very tiny, but yet the human sensory apparatus is sensitive to them in the low parts per billion threshold. So even though there's just a little bit in the hop, we happen to be quite sensitive to them. Balancing them out can be quite tricky.
Sounds like you can overdo it very easily there.
You can overdo it very easily, but these compounds are also extremely heat sensitive, so they can be lost upon drying the hop. Then, you know, you're losing a dimension to that hop. Like Cascade has a considerable amount of black currant body in it, but dried at temperatures over 100 degrees, you flash most of those off. So brewers are missing out there. And then to speed this along a little bit, getting down to the lower bottom level are the sulfur compounds, the ones that I just love to hate. Those are the ones that are responsible for all of the popular rage in the patented hop industry right now. Cat piss, that's where your cat pee lives. Interestingly, these compounds are also very, very small quantities, but whereas humans are sensitive to the citrus and some of the herbal or spicy characters in the parts per billion range, the sulfurous compounds we are sensitive to in the parts per trillion range, trillion with a T. As I tell the students, I said, imagine a sandbox full of white sand and one grain of pink sand and being able to walk up to it and say, there it is. That's what I'm talking about. Parts per trillion, very tiny. And there's all kinds of biological reasons for that. But they also can act to people who aren't as sensitive to sulfur. They can also act to bring a depth and a richness to those tropical and citrus flavors because they're very closely related on their energy scale. So it would be like the difference of having a pineapple that's not quite ripe and a pineapple that's about ready to rot. So that really, you know, ultra intense pineapple flavor can be thought of as being a combination of the sulfury compounds along with the pineapple compound. So
What would be an example of a beer style that would
anything hazy?
Okay,
right now anything hazy IPAs, you'd see that in IPAs all the time. Citra, Amarillo, Mosaic, Denali, all of these hops have a considerable amount of sulfury compounds in them, called thiols and mercaptans. And as humans, we are sensitive to them evolutionarily. So it sort of is like by itself, that sulfuriness is what skunks smell. It comes out the back end of a skunk. We also added that compound mercaptans, methyl mercaptans, to natural gas and propane so that we can smell it when there's a leak. So taken by itself, it's god awful, but you add it in with just a little bit of these other compounds and it's sort of like an aroma modifier and intensifier, unless you happen to be really sensitive to it, and then it just smells like cat pee.
So it takes a very special person as a brewer, I have to imagine, to recognize when that is going to create what they're looking for, because there is such an art to mixing this with others so that you don't just get the skunk.
Oh, yeah, totally. Exactly. And you've got to know when to add it in the boil. Like, so if you don't want the skunk, but you want everything else that's in that hop, then you put it in during the boil because those compounds are very heat sensitive and they will just flash off during the boiling process. So they won't be left in the beer. Like if you use CTZ in Columbus, which is very sulfury and oniony, and you put that in the dry hop, guess what? Guess what you're going to get?
You got an OG beer.
You got an OG beer. Whereas if you put it in the boil and you're using it as a bittering hop, then you're going to flash all those sulfurs off and they're never going to make it through to the finished product.
Okay, so that seems like as good a time as any to move away from these five classes and talk about the whens and the hows in terms of how you use certain things in order to get those end results that folks are looking for. So you just started talking about the addition timing, which I know is one of the things we wanted to speak about. I think you just covered it very well. Maybe back up just a tad there for folks that aren't necessarily brewers about the early versus late addition and just at a very high level how that works in terms of the additions.
We have to think of, I talked about energies of these compounds and how much energy does it take in order to get it to basically flash off and fly away. Ideally, you want to flash off and fly away up your nose, but you don't want it necessarily to happen in the brew house. So keeping that in mind, if you have a compound that is floral, and we know that those take very little energy to go away, you wouldn't put that in the boil side if that's the attribute you want to keep. You want to put that on the cold side. So that would be in fermentation or dry hopping scenario, as opposed to something that requires a lot of heat or a lot of energy to become aromatic. Like we talked about the herbal character, humulene, that actually is by itself really not all that fragrant. It requires oxidation to really become aromatic. So we got to boil the living hell out of that molecule. It's not very volatile. So it can survive boiling temperatures, no problem, and sort of force it to become aromatic. So that would be something if you wanted an herbal beer or to really maximize those characters, you'd put that in during the boil and maybe even earlier than you would just to get bitterness, because it takes a lot of energy to turn that compound aromatic. So understanding the chemistry, what we call physical chemistry of these compounds, is really important for brewers to maximize and or minimize the attributes that they're looking for. And unfortunately, it's not something that's well taught in the brewing industry, which is what we're hoping to change through this podcast.
I imagine there's a learning process every brewer goes through when they boil off everything they wanted out of a hop, or on the flip side, they keep it, you know, by adding too early, or on the flip side, by adding too late, they lose everything they wanted, and the end result is too much or too little, and they go back to the drawing board there.
Right, and oftentimes you'll get, let's go one step further, which is saying, well, I need more, or I got to make sure I have all of the aroma out of the hops into the beer, so when I go to dry hop, I'm going to leave my dry hops sit in that beer for 2 weeks, and then I'm going to pull it out because then, you know, it's absolutely extracted everything I can possibly extract. Well, I got a news flash for you, kiddos. At room temperature, the extraction process is done in 4 to 6 hours. You're done. Any longer time after that, you start pulling out other compounds that you may or may not want. And that's a lot of times where you get, I don't know if you've ever had a beer that's, really heavy dry hopped, or an IPA really heavily dry hopped, and it's got sort of this vegetal kind of astringency underneath
of it.
Sure. Yeah. They let the dry hop sit on there too long. So you start pulling out all of these gigantic skyscraper sized molecules that you don't necessarily want in your beer. And this blows most brewers' minds when I teach them this, that at room temperature, your dry hop extraction is absolutely done in 6 hours. If you're doing it in the cooler at, you know, close to freezing, let's say 34 to 38 degrees Fahrenheit, it usually takes up to about 3 days. Then the extraction is finished. You're done taking out all the good stuff. Notice I did not say anything about flavor development. Mm-hmm. I said extraction. So the chemical extraction is finished. Chemical extraction is time and temperature and concentration, and that's it. There's no other magic that's going on there. So get your hops out of the frickin' beer. Otherwise, you're going to start pulling in all this other stuff that you don't want. That blows people's minds. The other thing that blows their minds about dry hop additions is more is definitely not better. And certainly from an efficiency standpoint, remember I said time and temperature are the two of the critical factors for extraction rates. But you've also got concentration. So think about it this way. Think about, you know, the sugar you put in your coffee this morning. You put one teaspoon in your steaming hot coffee and it dissolves. Pretty easy, right? What if you put 40 in there? You probably you wouldn't get it all. It's not all going to dissolve. Well, there's a reason for that. There's just no more space in the liquid to dissolve it. Same thing happens with beer and hops. And Tom Shellhammer out at Oregon State did a great research project where he discovered that the absolute maximum quantity of dry hopping that a barrel of beer can absorb is 1.8 pounds. 1.8 pounds of dry hop per barrel is about as much as you can cram in there and actually get a complete extraction from. So these people that are dry hopping with 3 and 4 pounds per barrel, they're wasting money because you're never going to extract it into the liquid. There just isn't enough liquid to do the extraction. And that just, again, that just blows people's minds because they think more is better. More is definitely not better.
I can only imagine what that maximum rate, you know, what that's going to end up tasting like when you cram so much.
When you're up against the ropes here regarding time and temperature and concentration, you're going to start extracting, preferentially extracting compounds that will more easily dissolve into solution and fit in those spaces in between the liquid molecules. So you're going to preferentially start extracting compounds, and some of those are good, some of them are not so good. And you're also just, moreover, just flat out wasting money. So for those brewers listening, you can cut your dry hopping in half and still get, and maybe even get better quality because you're going to do a more complete extraction on the hops that are there. Make sense?
It does. So what else on, there are definitely two sides to this whole thing. There's where you're getting your aroma from a brewing perspective and how you're optimizing that. And there's, of course, on the growing side, how to maximize what you're getting as you're growing and harvesting and drying and preparing. So have we hit everything on the brewer side before?
I think everything that we can cover in this time frame. So
okay, what about the one thing? What about different varieties and how you serve the beer at the end of the day? Is there an impact there?
Hell yes. Temperature has a big deal to do. Temperature is a measure of energy. And if you are serving your beer too damn cold, those molecules are going to be so slow and they're going to have so little energy, they're not going to flash off up your nose. And if they're not flashing off up your nose, you're not getting the sensory experience. Same thing, if the beer's too warm, then maybe you're going to start flashing off some of those compounds that you would rather not, like the sulfurs and the heavier molecules that would normally just go down your gullet.
And I'd be willing to bet that the physical limitations being what they are, most, whether it's a tap room, brewery, or just a bar, they've got one cooler at a consistent temperature where all the kegs are lined up and hosed up to tap. So it's not as if they're able to adjust based on the style and the optimal temperature.
That's one of the reasons why real ales are such a big deal. And certain, while here in the States, over in England, it's sort of like, well, duh, that's how you serve beer at room temperature. Because that style of beer is made to be served at room temperature as opposed to, you know, 38 degrees Fahrenheit. And yeah, all of your tap lines are running out of one cooler. And meh. So, or it may be one of the reasons why you love this juicy, hazy IPA when it's served ice cold, but you sit and you gab with your friends and you've only quaffed down a third of the pint, 45 minutes later it's warm and you don't like it anymore. It's because it's warmed up. And, you know, temperature also has an impact on mouthfeel and just the physical chemistry of the liquid. But yeah, you just thought this was easy, drinking beer.
Well, it is. I expect it to be served to me properly.
Oh, yeah. Well, you have your expectations are set way too high.
Customer's always right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Come on. All right. So let's hit the grower side now. You know, we've talked about hop quality in depth, and we've talked about it from the sense that you want to be proud of your product. you want to present it in a way that the brewer understands your product is, you know, this mythical quality, mm-hmm. in air quotes. But how do hop production practices impact
the aroma compounds themselves are Mother Nature's kitchen. So we have to be, you know, willing to accept the fact that we're going to have good years and bad years, even if we do everything right culturally. Mother Nature's cooking, we're just serving the food. Keep that in mind when we're talking about, well, you know, last year these, you know, Centennial were fantastic, and this year they smell like hay. Sorry, there's not a lot I can do about it. The things that we can do something about are harvest timing is number one, and we talked about that in our quality podcast. Get the harvest timing right is number one. Number two, dry your hops with as little heat as possible, because all of these aroma compounds, I've been talking about energies, heat is energy. Heat will drive these aroma molecules out of your hops. And as a non-traditional small-scale hop grower, you need all the help you can get to compete with the big guys out west that use high heat to dry their hops. So don't use heat. You know, if you need to move a lot of water from your hops, move a lot more air and use dehumidification. So if we're not adding heat, you're keeping those molecules in the hop so that they can go into the beer. Then I would say the third biggest thing is packaging. Making sure you've got these hops packaged correctly, because oxygen is what's going to start degrading the process. Aside from just, you know, losses due to you know, them becoming gases, these molecules becoming gases, oxygen really gets in and causes havoc and breaks these things apart. And in most cases, it breaks these compounds apart into other compounds that you don't want. So, you know, your cheesiness is one of those compounds. So isovaleric acid. So we want to keep O2 away from the product, and so make sure you have them packaged correctly. I like to tell people the absolute best thing a hop grower can do is do no harm. Mother Nature's cooking up the feast. We just got to make sure we don't drop it on the floor on the way to the banquet table.
Starting with, yes, cat pee, and so much technical jargon here, and so much that goes into the aromas to get just the right thing out of them. Final words, I guess, on aroma, and it's so important as a brewer to know what you're doing there. It goes without saying on a variety of levels, but on that smell and how it affects the taste. I'm just struggling with the marketing side of this at a consumer level. You know, certainly you're going to get a pint, or in this day and age, more so, you know, folks are drinking from flights and trying a lot of things. That aroma is so important for the final taste and the final flavor. Would love to hear from some of you, our listeners, you know, in the comments on things that turn you on and almost more importantly, turn you off on aromas. And if you've got questions on what some of these mean in more depth, because we certainly went into floral versus piney versus citrus. The best way to learn is to taste, is to go ahead and try, yeah, stuff. Yep. It's easy to say.
Totally. And you want to, I would add, just, you know, interface as the consumer with the brewer and let them know what you're seeing and what you're experiencing. And in brewers, it's not so much trial and error. There is a lot of science behind this. So I would urge you to learn and dive more deeply into this stuff. It can be daunting, but it's absolutely critical to the outcome and everything that you're doing. There's so many things you don't have control over. This kind of thing you do. So we know how it works. We know what the chemistry is. So if you have questions on it, you can absolutely, I want to hear from you. Ask us questions, ask us technical questions so we can get back to you. We want to engage with you. We want to make this forum impactful, positively impactful for what you're doing.
As a consumer, you know, we spoke last time about, or one time, I keep saying last time, and depends on what order you're listening to our podcasts in, but when it comes to quality, the fact that you need to be educated, and just the statement, well, these aren't the quality I'm looking for, that's not good enough. Be educated on what quality is. It's the same thing here. As a consumer, when you're drinking, you need to know what it is. You may know what you like when you taste it or when you smell it, but try and understand a little more about why you like what you like. It helps you be, it helps you look for the right things. It helps you ask your brewer for the right things. And if you are going to go into growing or home brewing, it helps you know how to build toward
the right things. If you know why you like what you like, it's a lot easier to seek out other things that you're going to like than just trial and error and be horribly surprised.
Yes. It's tough when you take a first sip of something that you don't like to then go back to something you like, and you need that glass of seltzer in between.
Oh, yeah,
to
cleanse and sniffing your elbow and coffee grounds and all kinds of other stuff. I know we're going to call this episode Cat Pee and Old Lady Perfume.
Okay, I had written down the cat pee, but cat pee and old yep. lady perfume. All right, I will make a note of that. Pairings and how you bring them with things, but really to get into some of the national brands, the folks people will understand. And hey, well, if you're drinking, an example is this. If you're drinking this, this is what we're talking mm-hmm. about. It's tough because I know regionally you and I both are very attuned to what we can get right. around here. Probably more so than, hey, what am I getting out of a Sam Adams Boston Lager that everyone has access to? What are some of the aromas that I would associate with that so that we can make this more digestible by a larger audience, I'll say.
Agreed.
Thank you for that knowledge dump. And we won't attribute any of the aromas to that necessarily.
Oh, there is one, I can assure you.
Thanks for joining us, everyone. Subscribe to the podcast. You know the drill.